We'll call together a meeting of the Senate Interim Committee on General Government, Consumer, and Small Business Protection, and welcome. We got some housekeeping stuff to do first, and first is going to be the introduction of committee measures.
Sure. You want to open a work session on that?
Okay, so we will open up a work session so we can introduce committee measures. Senator Mona Sanderson.
Yes. Vice Chair George, I move that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 10094, dated 11-6-14, LC 1095, dated 11-7-14, LC 1096, dated 11-24-14, LC 1146, dated 9-8-14, LC 1148, dated 9-15-14, LC 1173, dated 10-10-14, LC 1385, dated 11-3-14, LC 1386, dated 11-4-14, and LC 1731, dated 10-2-14.
Senator Mona Sanderson has moved the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 1094, LC 1095, LC 1096, LC 1146, LC 1148, LC 1173, LC 1385, LC 1386, LC 1731. I want to say as a qualifying statement that a vote in favor of introducing a legislative concept is not a vote on the merits of the concept itself, and it is not indicative of the member's opinion or position on the concept or the contents of the concept. So we'll say that on the record. Is there any further discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, then these measures are introduced as committee bills. On the agenda today, we have a series of informational meetings, and Jana, which one do you want to take first?
Vice Chair George, members of the committee, we're going to start out with a hearing on community public offerings. So if we could have Aaron Teverbo and Rick Blackwell, please come up.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record.
Sure. Vice Chair George, members of the committee, I'm Rick Blackwell. I'm a senior policy analyst with the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, a unit of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. With me is my colleague, Aaron Teverbaugh. The mission of the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities is, and sorry for reading this, to encourage the widest possible range of financial services, products, and information for Oregonians delivered in a safe, sound, equitable, and fraud-free manner. So thank you for the invitation to talk about the community public offerings, which is generally known as crowdfunding. As I'll explain, we've proposed a balanced approach through administrative rule that will allow small businesses to raise funds while protecting individual investors. So I suppose the question to start out with is, what is crowdfunding in general? In the most general sense, it's collecting large amounts of investment money from small amounts of money from a large number of investors. So most of the time, crowdfunding in the United States is typically for a product, but what community public offerings are about is equity shares, so a part of a company. Equity shares are also investment contracts under a complex legal test from the United States Supreme Court, which is where we come in, because then they become securities. The general goals of, typically in Oregon, securities are registered, so we go through the prospectuses and the advertisements and make sure that that the goals of ensuring investors are receiving significant information and deterring fraud and misrepresentation are met, or preventing that at least. In the states that have allowed crowdfunding, it's usually treated as an exemption from this registration process or some sort of very abbreviated registration statement, so a one-page statement that allows a person to register and start crowdfunding. 15 states so far have taken action to allow crowdfunding, whether that's by legislation or, in the case of Idaho, Georgia, and Kansas, by administrative rule or order. It's a very new phenomenon. We don't have a lot of data on how well this is working or how many crowdfunded businesses are out there. But as an analog, since 2009, the website Kickstarter has raised almost $1 billion from 7 million contributors. So there's obviously demand is out there. So why did we act to enable crowdfunding? There's three reasons that I would point out. The one is that small businesses do need a range of financial tools in order to access relatively small amounts of capital. We know that the vast majority of employers in the state are small businesses. Somewhere around 100,000 businesses, or 96%, are employing 50 or fewer people. Even though our community financial institutions do their best to provide lending opportunities to small businesses, sometimes they still do struggle with obtaining credit. I ran across a study from the Main Street Alliance that said 36% of small businesses were turned down for a loan, and 37% were discouraged from applying. So there's clearly still a need for funding. And even despite the tools that are available now, Oregon businesses are using what they have to raise large amounts of funds. One of Kickstarter's big successes in 2014 was a cooler. You may have heard about it. It's called the Coolest Cooler, solar-powered, blender-equipped, very interesting device. But they raised $13 million from across the country from 62,000 contributors. So there's clearly a need for small businesses to find the capital they need to hire workers or to develop product. Any proposal would actually join a range of tools that we've already developed, considering things like streamlined registrations for small businesses, what we call a SCORE offering. Certain limited exemptions to small numbers of folks that are not high worth, and to a larger range of folks that are high net worth, which we call a Rule 506 offering. Won't get into that too far, but the point is there are tools available for others. But despite that small businesses need this capital, the likelihood of fraud or misrepresentations when someone can raise small funds from a large amount of people is something that we're concerned about. So one of the other, I guess, not success stories about crowdfunding is a company that was raising money to do horror-themed playing cards. And I mean, you know, this is a place that you can get potato salad funded, so I don't know what happens on Kickstarter necessarily. But the developers of the playing cards raised about $25,000 from 800 backers, did nothing with the money, and they ended up getting sued by the Washington State Attorney General for not delivering. So there's clearly, while there's success stories towards crowdfunding, there are also cautionary tales that we need to keep in mind. And even if the vast majority of users of the community public offerings will end up being legitimate businesses, you know, these are startups that might fail within 5 years. How do you value the equity that you're getting? So there are concerns that investors need to know when they're going in to make sound decisions about their investment. So with that, I'll go ahead and turn over to my colleague to talk about the specifics of the community public offering rules.
So. For the record, my name is Erin Tiberbaugh. I'm working at the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities as a policy analyst. I've been working on these rules. They came to us from stakeholders from the community who were interested in making sure that businesses had alternatives to capital formation. One of the statistics that they provided for us was that the average loan from a bank is $300,000, but most small businesses need somewhere between $25,000 and $250,000. So the idea was to craft an exemption that, while not completely self-executing, would be simple enough for unsophisticated businesses who didn't have the wherewithal to hire attorneys, or who had attorneys on staff, or people who come in and audit their finances, something that was relatively simple to do, but that still had the protections of, if not full-blown registration, at least the other exemptions that were out there. Normal types of protections for investors, registration, we have requirements that investors be sophisticated, that they know what they're getting into, that the businesses have reporting, that sometimes they do audited financials, that there are brokers, and that they cannot advertise. And so on the other side of that, trying to help businesses with the capital formation, the registration kind of went away, and instead it's a notice filing. We're not relying on sophisticated investors. We're relying on everyday investors with small amounts of funds. So these aren't necessarily folks who have a lot to lose. They're also not folks who necessarily have a background in finances and stocks and equity and the rest of it. The businesses themselves, while there's reporting required to make sure that you let your investors know what types of activities you're doing with the money, how the business is doing, what you're paying your officers, your owners, your bookkeepers, that sort of stuff, there's there aren't really heavy reporting requirements. There aren't audited financials. Took out the possibility for fees or remuneration commissions for brokers, and so we don't have brokers going into it. A lot of times brokers protect the individual investor by deciding whether or not this is a suitable investment. So in this case, we're going to have to rely to a certain amount on disclosures that the investors themselves understand whether or not this is a suitable investment for them. There is advertising. When you're trying to get lots of investors to invest at least small amounts of money, you need to get the word out. And one of the key features of crowdfunding is a reliance on the internet. Many states have crafted it so that there's a portal that you're required to go through, and that portal is essentially a broker, sort of broker light. We don't have brokers, and we don't have platforms written into our draft rules. Right now, what we've got is the idea of a bulletin board, and that is where you would post the who, what, when, where, and why, essentially, of what your security offering would be, who you are, what your business is, what you're trying to raise the money for, how much money you're trying to raise, the terms of it. Is this an equity? Is this a debt? Are you going to be paid back with interest? Are you receiving a share of the company? And what the time for a payment would be. But that platform isn't going to be doing the selling. The selling is going to happen primarily through the issuers. So platforms are restricted. They're not allowed to, under the rules, to hold, transfer, possess investor money. They can transfer it on to a licensed broker or a licensed money transmitter for transmission to the issuer or to a bank account or to an escrow account, however it is that the issuer is pursuing their offering. Most of the protections are built into the relatively low limits. Overall, an issuer under this set of rules is limited to $250,000 a year. They can extend that year to 2 years if they haven't been able to meet their minimums, but it's no more than 2 years in order to get the amount of money that you need. They have to disclose both to the division in the initial notice filing and to investors in the disclosure material exactly what they're going to use that money for and exactly how much they need in order for it to succeed. They also need to disclose what's going to happen to that money if they don't end up raising enough. If an offering says, I need $10,000 for a new stove, and they're only able to get $7,000, we're not requiring that they put this into an escrow account, because that was more complexity, more bookkeeping, more fuss for the small business, who really, we just want them to be able to get the money that they need to be able to accelerate, grow, or start their business. But they do need to tell the investor that if I don't get $7,000, I can't get an onion oven, and I'm going to give this money back to you is one option. I'm going to invest in something else, which is another option. I'm going to keep the money and pay my officers. And at the very least, that needs to be very much up front before the investor decides whether or not they're going to put any sort of money into it. One of the other investor protections is an individual investor cap. No individual is able to contribute more than $2,500. So $2,500 is the maximum an individual can conceivably lose. This is a primary protector investment. The thought was between the members of the rulemaking advisory committee that $250,000, not everybody was going to put in that much, but those that did, if the business did not succeed and if the investment went south, that probably wouldn't be the difference between life and death for an individual that actually had that to invest up front. We've also tried to build in an educational component. Before an issuer can start a security offering, they're required to meet and review their business plan with the business technical service provider. This is one of the ideas that came from the stakeholders, and what the thought was is that the business technical service providers is the generic term for the small business development centers, the economic development districts, and various nonprofit accelerators or incubators what their mission is to assist small businesses in assessing their business plan, accessing capital, and making a success out of their small business. So before you are able to file a notice with the division, you have to certify that you have met with a business technical service provider who has reviewed your business plan. The thought was is that at least you have the you're taking these issuers and routing them through a system, an existing system that we already have to assist small businesses in getting their businesses off the ground and making sure that they're a success. There's standard disclosures required, who the issuer is, the contact information, the description of the business, how long you've been in business, the specific reason for the offering, the terms and conditions, and the minimum amount needed, and a large disclaimer up front that says, please understand that this is an investment. These are not reviewed by the state, by the feds, by the business technical service providers, and this is not something to enter into lightly. They're restricted to sales within the state of Oregon to Oregonians. That is one of the conditions of using the federal intrastate exemption. They must be an existing Oregon business. We've defined the existing Oregon business to be with 50 or fewer employees to make sure that we're really targeting the small businesses. And they have to be located in Oregon and issue stocks or bonds only to certified residents of Oregon. Before you're actually able to purchase a stock, you need to submit some sort of documentary evidence that you do reside in Oregon. Otherwise, that would fall heavily on the issuer. They would be not able to utilize the federal intrastate exemption, and that could get them in trouble. So we've tried to craft, really, with the help of our stakeholders in the Rule Advisory Committee, very simple rules to follow that are clear for both the investor coming in saying, investor, this is risky, a lot of these businesses fail, you're limited in the amount of money that you can invest toward them, and issuers, be warned, this is also a serious matter. If you don't follow the rules, if you step outside the intrastate exemption, if you are careless with your money, if you're careless with your business, that can also get you in trouble. And so we tried to draft it to protect both sides of the investor and the issuer. Any questions?
Aaron, I got a question. Obviously, in this situation, we can pretty much only regulate the business that is located in the state of Oregon, right? And if an Oregonian makes an investment in a business in New York, there's not really a way to protect that person, correct? That's the job of the state of New York to do that. Is that how these this regulation works?
Vice Chair, if I can punt to okay. Mr. Blackwell.
Vice Chair George, yes. Generally speaking, if a person is investing with a New York company, they're probably going to be protected or governed by the laws of the state or the is. And especially, securities is a very complicated area. I will say that I don't even know if New York has a similar type of crowdfunding exemption yet. But if there's an exemption similar, then it would essentially be a New York law. Yeah. Why are we aware if you cross state lines?
Gotcha. Any questions? Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What type of instrument is used to convey this relationship between the investor and the company?
Through the chair, Senator Bertschinger. It depends on whether or not this is an equity issue or a debit issue. We limited the number, the types of securities that could be issued under this just to keep it nice and simple. So it would be a certificate of stock from the company, or it would be essentially a terms of a debt repayment. I'm going to repay you at such and such interest within 5 years, something like that.
Okay. Oh, good.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Next, if we could have up Amy Pearl and Noah Brockman.
Good afternoon. Sir, all right.
Introduce yourself and go ahead.
So I'm Amy Pearl. I run a nonprofit in Portland, Oregon called Hatch Innovation, and I'm the one who kind of brought this forward. Had our first meeting May 27th in Hatch in Portland, invited a number of statewide stakeholders responsible for and interested in the success of small businesses in our state. One of my colleagues sitting to my right will be talking to you a little bit about that, but that has kind of where this started. And so for many states across the country, many of these laws were passed by sort of political or lawyers who've come forward. But this particular initiative started at the grassroots in Oregon. So it's kind of a nice shift from what we've seen in other states. And we believe that's going to help with uptake and make this benefit the state more so than in some other states. So that number, that 96.7% of businesses under 50 employees, is a pretty significant number. If you envision a pie chart, it's a really big part of the pie, as well as the number of investors who are suddenly able to engage in these businesses is truly 99%. So if you take both those pie charts excuse me, and overlap them, we have suddenly engaged a really large number of citizens in our economy, as well as a really large number of businesses who are now able to access this kind of community capital. So I thought I would go through, we kind of joke about the 10x, you know, angels look for 10x return of their money. So we sort of play with this 10x return for Oregon. So Aaron and Rick have sort of enumerated the elements of this particular law. So I thought I'd walk through what we see at the grassroots level of how we're going to see the benefits to Oregon. So if I can just walk through those a bit. So the first thing that we use is the term called compatible capital. So right now, if you're a small business and you are looking for money, you are either getting it from friends and family, or potentially if you qualify for angel, or excuse me, you go to a bank. Well, that deal is structured by the funder. So your requirements and the kind of money you're getting really isn't up to you. It's up to the funder. In this case, because entrepreneurs drive the deal, so the entrepreneur himself or herself actually creates the offering, that offering requires that they know exactly how much money they need, what they're going to use it for, and what the terms are that make it compatible to their business, their trajectory, the kinds of things they're going to buy, what the effort is, and that way that financial arrangement provides potentially a greater chance of success. The other piece of this with the limited publicity is that it increases the visibility of these businesses, increasing both the awareness of the capital needs and also the kinds of marketing capacity that a lot of these businesses are looking for, because now their customers can actually be shareholders or provide them with a loan. Because this is an intrastate law, it is really de facto local investing. And so that is suddenly something that we look at as a state as a whole. So we're going to be forced, really, to invest in our own state. And it provides something that's interesting in terms of data, that there is data on proximity. So when investors invest, the closer they invest to their the business, they actually tend to do better in terms of their investments. And when your investors are closer in proximity, businesses tend to do better. So there's also this notion that perhaps this may increase the chances of success for businesses as well as for investors. Right now, we are looking at doing a public launch of a number of businesses we're working with right now, and that date is January 22nd. We believe the law will be it'll sometime early January. The entrepreneurs we're working with will have filed their materials, and they will be able to offer securities to the public by that date. The range of businesses is interesting to note. So this isn't just mom-and-pop businesses that are, you know, the barbershop or the pie shop. While they are part of this this cohort, this first cohort, we have three manufacturing companies that will probably be global, very interested in their reach is global, as well as high-tech and traded sectors. So it isn't it's important to note the kinds of businesses that this may attract and that has already attracted are not necessarily unsophisticated business people. Some of these have had, this is their third or fourth business. So it's actually going to attract a wide range of businesses at all stages of development. The investor protections that Aaron outlined is a pretty substantial list, and that list of the disclosure documents that they have to put together are creating, I think, wiser and smarter businesses, things that they've never had to think about, but the entrepreneurs need to think about now, are transforming how they think about their business, and I think has good potential, really strong potential for creating smarter entrepreneurs. They also do semi-annual reporting, too, which is something that's important, and I don't know that that was mentioned. So they are maintaining relationship to their investors, whether they've sold notes or equity shares, that relationship to the investor is maintained, as is kind of responsible. And finally, the most significant, one of the things that we're really pleased about, and I think it's a good for the state of Oregon, and I'll turn this over to Noah, is this connectivity to our technical service providers and the infrastructure that exists in Oregon. So it's going to change their job description a little bit in terms of the kinds of things that they may be asked. Some of the folks from on the Small Business Development Centers or the Economic Development District professionals who work with businesses right now. But right now, because we built that into these rules that they have to meet in person with one of these TSPs, that's going to increase the chance that obviously this isn't someone from outside the state trying to scam us, but that they're real people and they're likely to be known to these folks, especially in rural Oregon. But that particular process of helping them is something that is, we believe, going to strengthen the relationship between the service providers and our entrepreneurs in Oregon. So finally, I think the thing to say is really this is going to be a very big addition of economic power to rural Oregon. So thank you for your time, and I'm going to hand this off to Noah.
Vice Chair George and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to present on the community public offering rules. For the record, my name is Noah Brockman. I lead the capital access team for the Oregon Small Business Development Center Network here in Oregon. Just a quick reminder on the SBDC network, we, since 1983, have provided no-cost business advising resources and education to Oregon small businesses. Just to give you a sense of how busy we are, last year we provided 7,500 small businesses across Oregon, 25,000 hours of business advising and counseling. And between 2011 and 13, we helped our clients access $98 million in capital through our efforts. Through my efforts, one of the stakeholders working with Amy and her group on the draft rules. Oregon SBDC Network sees these rules as a useful new tool for accessing capital that'll fill capital gaps where other sources of capital may decline to support a small business owner on their project, whether that's a traditional bank-type capital or non-traditional mission-based lender or provider of capital. We see these rules may also be useful to small business owners with a preference for engaging their local community through local investing. We believe it will provide Oregon small businesses a clear legal pathway for raising local capital statewide. The Oregon SBDC Network recognizes that while the proposed community public offering rules will allow Oregonians the freedom to raise local capital and invest in local companies leveraging the interstate exemption from SEC securities registration, it also requires great responsibility, both for Oregon small business issuers and resident investors, to do their own due diligence. So it's really the responsibility is with them. Impacts of implementation of these rules to the Oregon SBDC network and other technical service providers. As Aaron mentioned, it will require that a technical service provider reviews the business plan. That's something that the Oregon SBDC network has been doing since 1983 and will continue to do that. I'm sure other technical service providers will as well. Another thing that technical service providers may choose to do is to assist small business issuers to self-assess their own readiness or completeness to move forward with these rules. We can provide checklists to make sure that they've done their homework before they move forward. One thing we wouldn't do is provide a merit review, an assessment of whether or not their offering is a good deal or bad deal or otherwise. That's not something we would get into, just like we don't provide legal and tax advice. We suggest our encourage our clients to seek out accredited professionals for those matters. One of the things that the technical service providers can certainly help with is on the education side. So just to give you an example, last year in 2013, the Oregon SBDC network offered 1,100 education events around the state. This is something that we could certainly add to our lineup of classes, both to help educate the business sector as well as potential investors about these rules. So in closing, the Oregon SBDC network is gearing up with professional development for our business advisors around the state to provide support to businesses in Oregon that will be using these rules.
Great. Thank you very much. Any questions?
Just a clarification. Do we need legislation, or this is already happening?
Senator Anderson and Vice Chair, committee members, these are administrative rules.
They're administrative rules, and they're in place.
Draft rules are in place. Last day for comments are tomorrow by 5 p.m.
Okay. Great concept.
But to kind of follow up on that, this kind of funding is already going on via the internet, right? I mean, it's happening currently. There's no regulatory action.
So the difference between Kickstarter.
Yeah, let me help that.
Kickstarter is essentially if you support a business through Kickstarter, you're either giving a gift or you may get something in exchange. So it's basically a grant or maybe a grant with a reward. Mm-hmm. This is different because this is, you know, this could be equity through stock, where this could be a loan through debt.
It's a securities crowdfunding is the best way to think about it. So, and even crowdfunding across the states, some of the minimum, so our minimum is $2,500 per investor. In some states, it's $10,000. So ours is...
Or maximum.
The maximum. And so for some, you know, if you're going to invest $10,000, it's really not a little bit from a lot of people. So crowdfunding is one way of looking at it. But the idea that this is some local investing within the state and that it is securities-based investing is the distinction. And so Kickstarter is not a security.
So I know that there's Kickstarter, which is like donations almost to a business.
Right.
Then there's online sort of like this peer-to-peer lending process. It's almost like crowd lending, but
sure.
Where you can personally take out a loan
right.
from somebody, and there's facilitators online to
like
do that.
Like KivaZip?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And again, that's a no-interest loan. And so
there are some that are interest.
Sure, like Lending Club.
Yeah, that's for
exactly.
accredited investors.
But I think Lending Club went through the regulatory process of registering, and I think they register those securities with SEC. If they get into paying investors interest,
mm-hmm.
they have to register it.
Okay.
So there's websites like Fundable.com that's equity-based investing, and they have to be accredited investors to participate.
It's the 1%.
And those are located in a jurisdiction that then facilitates that brokerage in essence, right? So they'd be located someplace.
So essentially it's just an internet-based platform. Maybe it's based in Ohio or wherever it's based. But
the businesses can be based anywhere?
These businesses for these rules have to be registered in the state of Oregon with 80% of their assets and sales, right?
State
of Oregon.
Those are federally registered, and so what we're talking about is what's happening across the state. There will be 50.
Okay.
There will be one per state, I think we can safely predict. So right now there are about 13 to 15 that have passed, and they all look slightly different. So, this is the intrastate exemption, which is, you know, the federal exemption that allows each state to do, to play with it a little bit and create their own unique rules that serve their state. So that's where, that's what we're talking about here.
And so I, what I'm getting confused about is that when we cross state lines, so we register these businesses in the state of Oregon to use crowdfunding, but let's say, for instance, a lender lives in Washington State, and they lend through the plat, they can't.
They can't.
So both, right. In this, these rules apply to both a lender and a borrower,
right.
Or a lend or a investor and a business owner being in the, inside the state of Oregon.
Correct. Correct.
All other things
Oregon
have to be.
And Oregon.
Okay. All right. Great. Yep. That's where I was getting confused. I was like, I'm not sure how you're doing
Oregon
this.
Oregon so. For Oregon
gotcha.
Is really a way to think about it. Yeah. Not every. So 100% of the investors must be Oregon residents.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. Very interesting.
Okay.
Thank you for your interest.
Our next topic coming forward is the foreclosure avoidance program. And Jenna, if you maybe give a little bit of introduction.
Certainly.
On this, or...
Vice Chair George, members of the committee. This committee in the past has done an awful lot of work on foreclosure and foreclosure avoidance programs. Today we're going to get an update on how those programs are working and what the general landscape in housing is right now. So we're going to have Janet Orth from the DOJ and Emily Raymond from NEDCO come up.
All right. Good afternoon, Vice Chair George, members of the committee. My name is Janet Borth. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Oregon Department of Justice, housed in the Financial Fraud and Consumer Protection Division. And I've also been the point person for DOJ on the Oregon Foreclosure Avoidance Program, and I'm here today in that capacity. As the committee might remember, in 2012, the Oregon legislature passed Senate Bill 1552, creating a foreclosure mediation program for a variety of reasons. That iteration of the program was little used, and in the 2013 session, with the help of this committee, Senate Bill 558 was passed. Senate Bill 558 went into effect on August 4th, 2013. The real basic structure of the process as it exists today is that a pre-foreclosure resolution conference needs to be allowed to a homeowner. And so the lender, or if I say beneficiary, lender and beneficiary, I mean the same thing. The lender will initiate a case through our central portal, and a notice is sent out to the homeowner that the lender has initiated a case. The homeowner then has 25 days to pay a fee and submit some documents. If the homeowner does not pay that fee within those 25 days, the lender receives a certificate of compliance and can is free to foreclose on the homeowner. If the homeowner pays the fee, they submit some, like I said, some basic documents, at which point the homeowner and lender exchange documents back and forth through a web-based portal. There just is a lot of document exchange in this process, and ultimately we'll have the opportunity to meet in person at a resolution conference with a third-party neutral as a facilitator. I provided the committee with a document with a few basic statistics. The first figure that you'll see is demonstrates the blue bar shows the number of requests. That's the number of cases that are started by a beneficiary each month. I think the more valuable number or valuable of the two colors is the red bar. That shows the that indicates that a beneficiary completed the request. So they got all the homeowner's information in, the basic initial processing fee, and a note, that initial notice went out to the homeowner that gives the homeowner 25 days to respond with a fee. When Senate Bill 558 was passed, we thought that there would be a decent case volume. We weren't exactly sure what we would see. What I think really we found at pretty consistently throughout the program, we've been kind of hovering in the 800 to 1200 cases per month, some months a little higher, some months a little lower. So that's a pretty high volume, certainly a well-used program. Figure two, you may recall that smaller lenders are exempt from the program, and I think that's demonstrated in Figure 2, Wells Fargo, NationStar, Ocwen, Chase. You can see who the major users are, and then other represents much smaller users. Those could be subservicers or a servicer in some sort of special class. Turning to the next page of your handout, we've had over 3,000 grantors, homeowners, pay the fee for the program. That comes out to about a 23% participation rate. But we found that sometimes the program doesn't get necessarily accurate contact information, or a homeowner might be deceased. And so when you remove those cases, it's actually a 31% participation rate. Going into the agreements that are actually reached at the resolution conference, we've been able to track 118 pre-conference agreements. We think there's quite a few more. We only began tracking those agreements back in May. And those require self-reporting by the parties, and so we may not capture all the agreements that are reached pre-conference. We've had about 862 agreements reached at a conference, and in 968 cases, no agreement was reached at the conference. And there's a little over 1,000 cases still in progress. We've been able to capture the types of agreements that have been reached. The vast majority of agreements are aimed at retention. Trial period plans are the most common agreements. Those are trial modifications that will hopefully transition into a permanent modification. You can also see that we've had quite a few permanent modifications, reinstatements or payoffs, something for the homeowner to make the loan current, a forbearance agreement, giving the homeowner a little extra time to try to come up with a solution, and a small number of cases through OHSI, which is the hardest hit program that was administered through Oregon Housing and Community Services using TARP money. All of that money has been distributed, so we don't expect to see more of those. There have been a few non-retention agreements, the majority of which have been short sales or deeds in lieu of foreclosure. The benefit of those agreements for the homeowner is that the homeowner can essentially repair their creditworthiness a little quicker and has the opportunity to be a homeowner again sooner. Some other type of forbearance agreement, so yes, we will foreclose on you, we'll give you an extra couple months to try to find a new place to live. And then voluntary surrender and cash for keys, those are functionally very essentially the same thing. The homeowner very likely is going to get some degree of relocation money in exchange for agreeing not to fight the foreclosure. We've also had, we conduct surveys at the end of every resolution conference, and we've been seeing good results from those surveys. 95% of homeowners would recommend the foreclosure avoidance program to someone in a similar circumstance. And the thing that jumps out to me with that statistic is that not that many homeowners are coming to agreements. And so what we've heard throughout the foreclosure crisis and going forward is that there's a general lack of communication, and there's frustration with just not being able to have a conversation with the lender. And so even where there's not an agreement, that goal is being met. 92% of homeowners rate the helpfulness of the housing counseling they're receiving as helpful or very helpful. 94% of homeowners are satisfied or very satisfied with the facilitator. On the lender side, 97% of lenders rate their overall opinion of the foreclosure avoidance program as neutral or better. And 86% of lenders are satisfied or very satisfied with the facilitator at the resolution conference.
Members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Emily Ryman, and for the last 4.5 years, I have overseen the foreclosure counseling programs at NEDCO, the Neighborhood Economic Development Corporation, and I've actually just stepped into a new role there as the interim executive director. Our program serves Lane, Marion, and Clackamas County, and is one of the largest foreclosure counseling agencies in the state. I want to begin today by thanking you for the opportunity to be here, because I fully recognize that I am only here because the legislature, and particularly this committee, had the foresight to pass this mediation program for Oregon homeowners, had the insight to make counseling an integral part of the program, and has continued to provide support for counseling by funding our network of agencies. I want to start by talking a little bit about the continued need for this program and for foreclosure counseling. There's been a lot of press recently about the fact that economic indicators are starting to look up. Unemployment rates are going down. Housing prices are ticking back in the right direction. And although I hate to focus on doom and gloom, I think that we in the industry still see a lot of statistics that indicate an ongoing need for this program. In particular, there are still more than 22,000 Oregon homeowners who are more than 90 days delinquent on their mortgage, and there are more than 41,000 homeowners who are still underwater on their house. And that's an interesting indicator because when somebody is underwater in their mortgage, they are basically one life event away from delinquency and possible foreclosure. They don't have the option of just selling the home as they might have in a traditional economy. They, because they're underwater, are stuck in that house and don't have the traditional options. Also, we see time and again, although unemployment rates are going down, anecdotally, we see homeowners all the time who lost higher-paying jobs, and when they're able to reemploy, they're able to reemploy at lower-wage jobs, or potentially only for part-time. So although they are, in a sense, recovering and are reemployed again, they're not reemployed at the wages that they were making previously. And I think you see this it reflected in the OFA numbers in terms of the new cases that are being initiated, initially having a pretty steep climb and then staying very stable. We're not yet seeing those dip. We're seeing the same kind of numbers in the handout that I provided in terms of demand for counseling. Demand for counseling rose very steadily over the first half of this year, and it's staying quite high. We're at this point averaging between 180 and 200 new counseling cases statewide per month, and that really is the capacity of our counseling network. You'll see the case spike that happened in the summer, and we had a fairly crazy couple of months trying to accommodate the demand when those cases came through. I think there's also continuing need for this program in the fact that the mortgage servicing industry, although it may have made some gains since the extreme horror stories of 2010, 11, 12, is still a fairly dysfunctional system. So we track a lot of the settlements that happen nationally with various servicers who get their hands slapped for bad practices. A couple of my favorites recently, you may have seen the news stories about a relatively big servicer who was backdating their offer letter for assistance so that by the time homeowners received the letter, the offer had already expired. Another servicer recently was, they admitted in their settlement that literally their file room floor had buckled under the weight of the unopened assistance applications that were piling up that they were not opening or reading or processing, and they were just issuing mass denials to homeowners instead. We personally in the OFA program saw a lender a few months back who began participating in OFA, and yet after they filed cases into the program, their customer service reps were advising homeowners that the program was a scam or that they had been initiated by mistake and that they shouldn't pay their fee and they shouldn't participate. DOJ luckily stepped in on that one, and I think we have a lot of that sorted out. And lest you think that those stories are all a thing of the past, those have all happened in the last 6 months. So these are still these problems are still going on today. And homeowners who try to face that system on their own, I think, are very likely to end up in foreclosure and not with a workout option. The good news is that the OFA program is working. I think the last time we appeared before you as a committee, it was quite new. We weren't sure what to expect yet. We didn't have a lot of trends. But I think I speak for the counseling network across the state when I say we are very, very pleased with how it's working. We feel like the mechanisms involved in OFA, in terms of the document exchange process, the ability to get people into a room together, the lines of communication that are opened between the homeowner and the lender, lender with a counselor involved are all really positive. And although it may take more than one mediation, we're sometimes finding, because sometimes the homeowner's not ready, sometimes the lender's not ready, the program anticipated those quirks in the system and allows for a reconvene and another conference so that we can actually get to resolutions. Because of the OFA program, the lender attorneys and the housing counselors across the state have formed a pretty tight relationship. We meet about every 6 months to talk about how we can make the program work better, how we can improve the logistics of it. Even though many people might, from the outside, might think that we're adversaries, the counselors have discovered that sometimes the lender attorneys are actually our best ally, because what they want for their client is a performing loan, and what we want for our client is a performing loan. So it turns out there's a lot of common ground there. Because of the OFA program, the expertise and savvy of counselors across the state has grown tremendously. I'm really proud of our counseling network and the way that counselors across the state have learned to use the tools of this program to force an honest review of our client's application and make sure that they actually get reviewed on the merits of the case so that if they can avoid foreclosure, they are able to avoid foreclosure. And you see that in the results. I think in the results that DOJ just went over, but also I have the similar statistics on my handout for specifically those homeowners who worked with a counselor. And what we're seeing is that between resolutions that we're able to get to in the conference and between resolutions either reached before the conference or afterwards when they continue to work with counselors, about 70% of the participants we work with get to an agreement that allows them to avoid foreclosure, which I think far surpasses even the expectations that I had for how successful this program would be at helping people get to resolutions. And just to put a fun monetary statistic behind that, the Center for Responsible Lending a year or so back did a study about how much a foreclosure decreases the equity in or decreases the value of neighboring properties. And they did it state-specific. So for Oregon homes, when a home is foreclosed on, the neighboring properties each lose $10,000 in value on average. So if you think about that in terms of the 700 foreclosure avoidance agreements we've reached in the program so far, which I think is just the beginning. And you think about even if it's just the three most immediately adjoining properties, this program has potentially saved Oregon homeowners $21 million in value on their homes, not even taking into consideration the economic impact of the homeowner itself. That's just the neighboring properties. So I think that's a pretty interesting way to think about the impact that this program is having. I also think that one of the lessons we've learned is that counseling is maybe even more integral to the success of this program than we realized at the beginning. And that's a pretty universal assessment at this point. The lenders, the lender attorneys, the facilitators involved in the program, the homeowners themselves are pretty uniform in their support of counselor involvement to the extent that, in fact, if a homeowner shows up at a mediation without having met with a counselor, the facilitator and the lender's attorney are oftentimes jointly agreeing to set over the conference so that that person can go work with a housing counselor. And we hear time and again from the homeowners working through the program, even with the mechanisms involved, with the document exchange, with the portal, the communication involved, homeowners feel like they wouldn't be able to navigate that without the assistance of a counselor. They wouldn't be able to figure out all of the paperwork that they need. They wouldn't know how to respond to some of the quirkier requests from lenders. And so what we're hearing from everybody is that they want the counselors in the room. We're doing our best to meet that hope. I will say that the counseling network is pretty much at capacity right now. We are having to come up with a bit of a triage system to make the best use of our time. So if we know a conference is going to be set over, we might not be able to appear at that conference. We might wait and go to the next one. If a homeowner has an attorney, we might not be working with that homeowner because we just can't be at every conference. We can't work with every homeowner to the fullest extent right now. We just don't have the capacity. I would also add on that score that the eBoard allocated additional funding to the counseling network in September, which was fantastic. They made the very concerted decision to provide funding to get us through what we expect will be next March rather than the full biennium, just because we're all keeping an eye on the case numbers and the volume of people going through this program. And we don't want to, we as counselors don't want to ask for money that we end up not needing, and I'm sure you as legislators don't want to allocate it. So the eBoard made that allocation with the understanding that we would probably be coming back in March if demand remains about the same for additional funding to get us through the biennium. And I think, you know, my best guess, just watching industry trends and watching the clients coming through our door, is that I expect this program to remain at a pretty consistent volume, well into, if not through, the next biennium. So, you know, nobody has a crystal ball, but that's kind of my best guess. And I think that's probably where I will end, unless there are particular questions.
Any questions for the panel? Thank you both very much. Appreciate the update. So our next public hearing is on the topic of legislative oversight by agency rulemaking. And we do have Senator Winters here, which I'm guessing. And Senator Winters, maybe I should ask, is there anybody in particular that you want up with you, or do you want to testify?
No, you can have Dexter. You asked him
come. So Dexter and Belissa.
Okay. We're going to have Dexter Johnson and Belissa Sidlick up. We'd be great. Thank you.
Well, good afternoon, and for the record, my name is Senator Jackie Winters, and I live in Salem, and I represent Senate District 10, and it is so nice to see you today chairing this committee, Senator George.
Better take a picture.
Like one of my last panels.
Well, and so I'm very honored to be here before your last panel. And I'm here to, you know, actually, you know, talk about LC-2665. As you probably know, it's the content of LC-2665 is one that it's not that we've had in the past, that we've actually presented before to talk about oversight of administrative rules. Administrative rules, as you know, have the power of law without the benefit of refinement through the robust legislative vetting process. And unfortunately, I think agencies have been allowed to add rules with little, sometimes public notice, and even less public input at times. And every year, agencies create, they admin thousands and thousands of administrative rules. And when you think about it, you know, small businesses and the general public at large often struggle to keep up with the volume and the just the whole nature of the amount of rules that goes through this process. You know, Chair George and I think we've had this conversation before, and others in this building, about the how do we, as a legislative body, actually assure that those rules and regulations that are being promulgated by agencies actually reflect the intent of legislation that we, in fact, have passed through this august body. And to me, LC-2665 puts the brakes on some of the explosion of administrative rules and also provides us with an opportunity to actually to have some oversight to make certain that that balance between what legislatively we have promulgated and what actually the executive department and the authority, what they're actually implementing it. And for that reason, I, you know, I'm here today and have been for previous sessions, along with you and others, have wanted to be able to strike that balance and to assure that, one, that we don't have unnecessary administrative rules that actually become quite costly, actually, because with administrative rules often comes a price tag. But it also, I think, we need, when we look at it, the amount that I think we spend in this process, I think some of us think that we can use some of those dollars much wisely and more smarter in other areas. So I'm encouraged that you're hearing at one of your last acts, one of the LC-2665 that you and along with some of us have actually have discussed this issue, and hopefully that it can move forward. So I'm here today to be here as one of your colleagues to present something that I know that you care about as well as I do.
Senator Winters, one of the things I think is interesting about your background is you actually worked in the executive branch before you came to the legislature.
Yes.
And I think, I don't know if you could talk a little bit about your view of how that's changed in history from the time you worked in the executive branch to what working in the legislative branch as far as what agencies used to do versus what agencies do today, kind of from a historical perspective when you worked in the executive branch.
Well, from a historical perspective, there's several things that have happened since my years, and remember, I'm chronologically advantaged. Where the rulemaking authority then was not as robust in previous years as it is today. On the legislative side, there was a more attempt to have more oversight on what was occurring over in the executive branch. We've grown a lot since those years when I was on the executive branch. Government has changed both on the legislative side as well as the executive side tremendously. The volume has increased. In all fairness, it is the law itself that actually produces the administrative rule. And I think we have to keep that in mind as well. And I can still remember the debate when I was the state ombudsman with Frohmeyer, who was the attorney general, and we were on a panel together of talking about the chicken and the egg, which one created the most bureaucratic red tape. Whether it was the laws itself, and his argument was that as legislators on the legislative side, we took liberties then, on promulgating administrative rules. And, of course, it was being from the executive side, mine was that if you wrote clear and concise laws in the first place, we would not have that Mack truck to drive through. But I still, having seen both, if you actually began to look at the promulgation of rules and the extent to which they are promulgated, it's voluminous. And also, if you look at some of them go far beyond the intent of this legislative body. And yet this legislative body really does not, neither the staff capacity, do not have the currently where we do an oversight to say, hey, that really was not what we wanted to happen. And I think we need that balance. I think for the sake of the public, we need it. For the sake of small businesses, we need it. So often we get, all of us get calls from the general public about something that they did not know or something that a process that they had no in the rulemaking that they weren't notified of. So it's for that reason that I think LC 2665 is a positive approach for us to take.
Thank you. Dexter.
Chair George, members of the committee. Good afternoon. I'm Dexter Johnson, Legislative Counsel, and I'm here with Deputy Legislative Counsel Melissa Sidlick. I can give you an overview of the existing, or Melissa, actually I'll turn this over to Melissa, if that's your interest, is an overview of the existing administrative rule review process that's present in Legislative Council. Alternatively, I can talk about LC 2665. You'll note that is a constitutional amendment, and I can discuss with you why a constitutional amendment is necessary for there to be more legislative review of rules than there currently is. So what would be the committee's preference here?
And can I excuse myself?
Sure.
Thank you.
Well, see, I think we know what the process is, but how do we change it?
why don't we have an overview of the process, and then, Dexter, if you want, then you can kind of talk about the purpose of the constitutional amendment.
Okay, great. Then I'm going to turn it over to Melissa, who will talk about the existing process and the limited nature of its current where it is.
Vice Chair George, members of the committee, I'm Melissa Seidlick, Deputy Legislative Counsel. And really, this will just take a few minutes to describe to you the existing process that's been in place since 2009, when this body passed the new way that rules were going to be reviewed by Legislative Counsel's office. After an agency has gone through their rule-making process, they've published notices, held hearings, and then they've adopted a rule, they must file their certified copy of the rule with the Secretary of State. And by statute, within 10 days after doing that, they must submit copies to our office, Legislative Counsel's office. Once we receive that copy, that copy of the rule is given to a drafter with expertise in the subject matter of the rule. And that attorney then reviews the rule. And under statute, our office is charged with reviewing a rule for two things: whether or not the rule is within the intent and scope of the enabling legislation, and whether it raises any constitutional issues. And that is the extent of the statutory obligation of our office to review these rules at the current time. What happens in most cases is that the rule passes muster. And in a few instances, probably maybe 3 to 5%, there are problems with one of those standards. And what happens then is the attorney that is reviewing the rule contacts the agency to see if an informal resolution can take place, or that attorney will prepare what we call a negative determination letter. And that letter indicates that the agency has 30 days to respond in writing. Now, what usually happens is during this informal process of resolution, discussion takes place, the agency either agrees that the rule needs to be changed in particular ways or repealed, or a different rule needs to be adopted, and the negative determination goes away. And in very rare instances, it does not. When that happens, then the negative determination comes before an interim committee that has subject matter jurisdiction over the agency that issued the rule or that adopted the rule. And there's a hearing. Representatives from the agency as well as from our office appear. And if the interim committee adopts the negative determination of our office, it is placed on Legislative Counsel's website, where it stays until one of maybe four things happens. The rule is changed, a court deems the rule to be valid, the underlying legislation changes, or the constitutional defects get cured. And that is it in a nutshell. That is. Would you like to add anything to that, Dexter?
Well, I'll just stress a couple things. That the limited nature of our review, we really look at whether it's within the intent and scope of enabling legislation or that creates some other constitutional defect. And stress the limited effect of our finding that there's a problem. And when I say our finding, I actually mean the legislative committee's finding that there is a problem with the rule. The rule remains in effect. All that happens is we post the negative determination on our website, and perhaps some member of the public who is interested in challenging the rule might use that to bring an action in court. But the rule remains in effect, regardless of our finding, regardless of the legislative committee's findings. So what is the reason for that, and what is the reason for why I think there is interest in measures like LC 2665. The reason is based on the Oregon Constitution's requirement of separation of powers between the three branches. As I'm sure you're aware, the legislative branch is charged with legislating, and the executive branch is charged with implementing the policy decisions that you make. And administrative rules are a form of implementing those legislative decisions. So, there has for often, over the decades, been interest on the part of the legislature in having rules not take effect until once an agency promulgates the rule, until the legislature approves it. And that is, in our opinion, in the opinion of the Attorney General, and in court cases, not in Oregon, but in other states in the nation, a violation of separation of powers. And so in order to cure that, if it's the legislature's decision to have a more robust review that allows for an administrative rule to not take effect until the legislature or some committee of the legislature approves it, you need a constitutional amendment, and LC 2665 provides for that.
Great. Questions? Great. Thank you very much. And our last witness today is Jen Meekums from NFIB.
Do you need any hard copies? Thank you, Vice Chair George and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jan Meekums. I'm the State Director of NFIB, National Federation of Independent Business. We're an association of about over 7,000 small businesses within the state of Oregon. And we are truly small businesses, and we represent the truest sense of that word, in that we do have members that have 300 employees, but the average has less than 10 employees. And it's from throughout the state, every nature of enterprise, from sole proprietors, self-employed, to those that provide jobs for others. I was asked to address this from more of a global viewpoint, how regulation affects small businesses. And at the federal level, and I'm bringing that up because there's so many different jurisdictions that affects our members. So just at the federal level, there's over 4,000 regulations right now that are in the pipeline. And just the EPA compliance paperwork in 2012 alone took 176.2 million hours, it is estimated, and $2.4 billion to implement. That would be on a national level to implement those regulations. And that's a $30 million hour increase in the past 4 years. So that's just one area of regulation on the federal level. Then we come to Oregon, where we have 180 agencies that have produced, at last count, about 11,000 pages of regulation for businesses to abide by. So I think we all agree that this is just becoming out of control. Our businesses want to protect the employee. They want to protect our environment. They want to protect the consumer. We all agree on that. But we feel, as small businesses, this has gotten out of control. In 2012, Forbes had a quote that 55% of businesses would not go, small businesses would not start a company today. And of those, 69% reported that regulation had actually harmed their businesses. Add to that a Brookings Institute study that came out in May of 2014, stating they started collecting history of company births and company's deaths, as they call them, or entrances and exits, and it was always in the United States on an upward trend, more new businesses versus failed businesses. In 2008, that graph crossed. And it is continuing to be a wider span between the number of businesses that are being born in the United States to those that are exiting, which is a very disconcerting statistic, because if it continues and you carry it out, that has to do with our economic viability and it has to do with jobs. So that is disconcerting. While Regulation is a problem for all businesses. It's particularly a problem for small businesses. A particular regulation a larger business can absorb the cost in time or money to comply, where a small business, when you add all of these regulations to a small business, it can be very onerous for them in both cost of compliance and time of compliance. And I'm just to give you a few examples from our members in communications that I've had with our members. We had a member who had a foundry in Troutdale, and OSHA came through and found that in order that the requirements they had made it impossible for the workers to continue to operate, to do the activity of the foundry. So he actually closed his foundry, and 30 people lost their job. We had a pilot in Ontario, Oregon, that had worked with the Department of Fish and Wildlife for 23 years. He had a couple of different airplanes. He had some small planes that were very nimble and could go in and drop into the small mountain lakes and do research on wolves. They could restock the mountain lakes. And after 23 years, he lost a great portion of the state's contract because the insurance requirement that was required for him to carry was like $28,000 a year. And it was an opinion by an agency on a statute that had been passed that he would now have to require, he was now required to carry that level of insurance. They've tried to work through it. He has gotten some of the work back, but it's been financially devastating to him and other people, there are other flight small air businesses in Ontario that were affected in the same way. I had a call from a member who was a contractor, no employees, and he carried health insurance, but he didn't carry workers' comp on himself. Well, that rule changed, and now he has $4,000 a year that he has to pay in workers' comp on himself, which he said he cannot afford. And last was a member that I spoke to yesterday from Southern Oregon that has a small business. He's been in business for about 20 years, and we were talking about regulatory fees. And he has an annual metering fee that started out at about $360 annually. Now it's $1,380, which is a 400% increase. He put up a sign on the freeway to direct people to his business. It's just a state sign. He used a state vendor to create the signage. He used a state vendor to install the signage, and now he has an annual rate. He has an annual rent on that signage. And there's no requirement on the part of the state annually to do anything with this sign, and that rent's gone up about 200%. He has an underground annual tank permit that costs $1,300, and those funds go to take care of, to mitigate areas where there has been leakage into the environment. So not from anything he's done, but for something that's occurred with someone else or another entity, he has to pay $1,300 a year in a permit. He also has to provide annual liability insurance for if something happens with his tank, and so he would be covered. And his responsibility on that is $1,850 a year, along with an annual inspection of $1,000. So it's $4,150 a year that never, when he started business, did not exist. And what he, like any small business owner, has to do to make up for that, because it doesn't add anything to the bottom line, it just takes away from it, is they can not expand, not buy a piece of capital equipment, not hire another person, and in some cases they may even have to reduce their workforce. And this is just three regulatory requirements of 18 that he counted up. And it's not any one. It is the accumulation of all of the regulations from all of the agencies at all levels, from federal down to county, state, county, and city, that is just becoming so burdensome for our small businesses. There are two regulations, and I've provided copies of them for you. One is 2011 ORS 183 5.336, the cost of compliance effect on small business that requires a cost benefit to be done on regulations. And another one is ORS 183405, which requires an agency review of rules, which calls for a 5-year review after adoption of rules. And that they would have to be reviewed to such things as, has it created the required intent? Is it still needed? And what is the effect of it? And if it's obsolete, should it be eliminated? To my knowledge, those are not being implemented. And we're told they're not being implemented because it's a staff issue. They don't have the staff to implement it. But the implementation of these two statutes could have a dramatic effect on regulation on small businesses. And it might be a place for us to look instead of starting over, although we are absolutely in support of the LC 2665. So our wish list regarding regulation is we would like to have a voice in the regulatory process and be allowed to participate and expand. Another thing after they're passed is that sometimes there's a very swift result when a small business becomes under an inspection or under analysis, that it's a very punitive process instead of really trying to work with the business to overcome the non-compliance before there is a large penalty assessed. And we agree with the cost-benefit analysis for small business when we're looking at regulatory creation. And transparency, accountability, and what we're talking about with 2665 is the legislative oversight. So we acknowledge this is a very complex issue. It's taken a long time, decades, to get us where we are. It will not be solved in one legislative session. But we definitely appreciate this being opened. NFIB being asked to come before you today, and we support the essence of of LC 2665 in somehow creating that constitutional amendment that will allow more legislative oversight on our regulatory process. And with that, thank you very much, and I'm open to questions.
Thank you, Jan. Any questions? Senator Burscher.
Thanks, Jan, for that. Sure. And I'll speak as a business owner from over 30 years. You know, I've been through a lot of trials and tribulations, and with the business, wasn't making money or this or that, and I never said I was going to give up. I never said I was going to quit. But if I had a nickel for every time I learned of a new rule that I had to comply with, that's when I said, that's it, I'm quitting. It's that simple. And some of them are almost impossible to comply. I mean, it costs a lot of money to comply with some of this stuff. And the worst ones are the ones you don't even know about until you have a violation of a rule you had no idea you even had. And so I really appreciate, you know, you coming forward, and Senator Winters, when I have dinner with her tonight, I'll thank her, that this is something that truly does affect businesses. It really does. A real good friend of mine who owns several businesses, we talk to each other almost every day, and when I call him or he calls me and we say, what are you doing? Most of the time we say, I'm sitting at my desk complying, mm-hmm. is what we say. How much time we sit at our desk complying. So I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Additional questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jan, I guess I just want to kind of go through a couple things. I think we're all in agreement. We can't do anything about what the federal government's doing regarding their rulemaking. Is that a fair statement?
Absolutely a fair statement, but I felt it was important just to express the level, the quantity of compliance that we have to deal with as small business.
Well, I'm assuming NFIB is not saying because there's so much happening at the federal level that we as states should not consider health and safety issues and other performance measures that just because the feds are doing so much.
No, I'm not suggesting that. We're fighting this issue at the federal level, mm-hmm. NFIB is, and obviously we're advocating at the state level as well.
Okay, well, great. If I could, Mr. Chair, a couple other questions. I guess one, just a statement. I looked at your wish list, and I guess I just need to kind of go through this. Under the current rulemaking process, my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, before a rule goes in effect, unless it's something as an emergency where they may have some expeditious power to move something forward because of health and safety, there's a requirement for notice. That notice is published as required by state law. Comments period is allows for your members to comment. And then sometimes there actually are hearings. So what
yes,
part?
Yes, sometimes there are hearings.
Yeah, sometimes there are. I understand they're not always, but what part of that that we currently have does your membership feel we need to do different than notice, comments, and potentially hearings?
That's a very good point, and I think it's probably more the burden may fall more on us than on the process. The process can be overwhelming for small businesses to engage in. They don't know how. And I think the Secretary of State has made great strides in the last couple legislative sessions. And one is the Office of Small Business Assistance to help with these issues. And some of it, I mean, when you've got 180 agencies and they're all making rules, how do we go about being engaged is part of the problem, too. But I agree with you, the process in itself, we probably just aren't taking advantage of it to the extent that it is available.
Yeah. So the other thing, I guess, with your age, with your association for your different members, I'm assuming y'all are doing some type of oversight as to what's coming in. Do you do some type of publications or notification to your members that these rules are coming out of whatever agency where they might get that information?
Mm-hmm. That's a good point, too. We advocate as far as legislation is concerned, and we make available the labor laws as they're required to be posted. We make that available. But we're not able to, we don't have the capacity for, as we represent taxes and workers' comp and health insurance and anything that impacts business involves us. We don't operate in trade specific. So we don't have the capacity and are not intended to provide all of the information to all of our members on all business issues that would affect them. To some extent, they would need to do that, and we do try and familiarize themselves, have the Secretary of State's office, have the different agencies come before a workers' comp, revenue, come before our members and member meetings that we promote so that they can have that one-on-one exposure to the agencies and that affect their businesses.
Mr. Chair, that might be a place where someone who wanted to, say, facilitate more than what NFIB is able to do is actually have the ability to take these, because there's notice electronically. It just seems like you could just take it and post it. And, of course, it would fall on your members, obligations to look at the list, but at least there'd be some type of potential, oh, there's something happening here. Maybe I should engage more.
Yes.
The last question I have is kind of segues with your answer on the last one. Knowing what I understand about how LC 2665 will work and giving more oversight for the legislative process, we also have limitations on resources.
Yep.
So would your members actually support having a broader sense of the legislature? You know, Congress meets year-round, full-time, just like California does. It costs a lot of money to do that. But what I'm hearing, what LC 2665 could end up, is that you would have these various rules that are made by an agency sit until the legislature, through whatever process, and I would assume, Mr. Chair, would go through a committee of jurisdiction, is what we've heard from Dexter Johnston, to actually review it, which would mean we would have to be here more often than we are. So do you know if your membership would actually support having a, lack of better terms, a more full-time legislature to take on these tasks?
Yeah. I couldn't answer that for them, and we are a member-driven organization that we ballot our members, and we have never balloted that question. I did come across just today, and I just perused it, but it was a rulemaking streamlining that Arizona did, I think in 2012, that had some interesting concepts to it, that it actually gave the agencies more leeway under certain circumstances and then less under others, but it was meant to streamline and simplify. And I'm happy to provide it to the committee, what they did, to see if there are some ideas there that would help. And I think that what you're communicating about the legislature, what was communicated about LC and the agencies, what we communicate in our organization and our businesses communicate in their organization, we all are getting to the point where we're all overwhelmed with the tasks before us and the means that we have to deal with those tasks. And so I think that, again, it's a working together to recognizing those issues and see what we can do to deal with them.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, the last thing I guess I would say is, Jan, thank you very much for coming forward. I guess from my perspective, for the number of years I've had the opportunity to serve here, I see this as a citizen legislature, and I really embrace that because I think it gets us and keeps us more in our community, like me being in court all day this morning before mm-hmm. I got here. And so those are the type of scenarios that I think we have to balance as to what is our citizenry going to want. And, you know, clearly if we're going to ask more tasks to be done at whatever level, we have to be ready to, say, facilitate that with providing the resources, the cost for doing that. But thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Thank you, Jan, for coming. I really appreciate your testimony. And I'm not sure how LC 2625 is going to address some of your issues. I really liked how you pointed out the 2011 ORS 183.336 and the 2011 ORS 183.405, the agency review of rules, you know, after a five-year review. I mean, those types of issues, if that's in statute and we're not actually implementing because of staffing issues, I think that needs to be brought to the attention of whoever, because then I think some of the issues could be addressed. I've been to some of the administrative rules. I'm on the list, and they send me, you know, when administrative rules are. And it, they always, when I see it, they have public comment. But then I hear that some don't. But it is overwhelming. And I would like to see some of the issues vetted. Not sure LC 2625 could actually do that, but I do like these two suggestions for us to sort of look at or follow up on that you mentioned on those ORSs, that because I think that would address some of the issues.
Senator Marshall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One quick example, because I know we all want to get out of here, but we just had the rulemaking on essential salmonoid habitat, and they did meetings all over the state. And when I showed up to the meeting at Grants Pass, there was just a handful of people there. And so I had my staff research it. It was never in any of the publications. It was never advertised locally. It was never, nobody knew about it. Nobody knew about it. If nobody knows about it, nobody's going to show up, you know. And so I think we have to look at how do we get that information out to people mm-hmm. to give them the you know, in my career, it's always been, it's, I never knew about it until it was already implemented most of the time. So thank you.
Just a comment, I guess, would be that, you know, it's interesting because we do find ourselves faced with these issues, and then most of it's resource driven. And I think we all know that if we're going to provide those resources, what does that mean? Does that mean we're going to take away funding for what other programs that might be going on? Or are we going to be asking for your members to be paying more fees to actually have more oversight by, you know, the legislature or even within the executive branch process? And I think, and that's the same thing as Senator Laurie Smanders Anderson brought up. I mean, I think it's wonderful that we have on the books. I wish we were, in fact, being able to fund these five-year reviews. We've started doing that with tax credits and having those reviewed just to make certain they're doing what we intended them to do when they were first implemented. Mm-hmm. And a review's great, but it also has the, requirement to be able to actually carry that out.
Yes.
Any other questions? Jen, I guess I'd say this. To get an idea, over the last 12 months, I've taken two of my best staffers and actually just taken them and made them full-time regulatory compliance officers. So I have two full-time staffers who do nothing but do regulatory compliance. And our business is big enough that we can pass that cost on and somebody eats that cost other than me. But my small competitors are bumping up against this. And in the last 18 months, we've lost four competitors in our field who can't comply with that. So you get big enough and you can bypass it. But I think you hit exactly what it is. You can't, at a small business level, you cannot pay for having full-time compliance officers in these situations. And the bigger your business is, if you can get through that last thing and be able to get to that size where you can, well, then you can absorb some of those costs. But I would say that for small businesses, I know exactly your testimony is on point. So great. Jan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Colleagues,
thank you
so much. It was real pleasure being able to be with you guys today, my last hearing, and I really appreciate it. And tomorrow's my last floor session. I'm all excited about that. I guess we'll call this adjourned. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.